At 8 o'clock in the morning on October 26, 1964, Eric Edgar Cook was the last inmate made to swing in the prison gallows. Despite his burial at an unmarked grave, Cook left behind a legacy that would never go away. Hello again, and welcome to Of Monsters and Mad Men. It has been a long time since we've done an episode, and I realize this, but I hope you guys are still around. I hope you're in the true crime mindset. Not literally, but at least to enjoy this story. So without further ado, let's get into this. The trapdoor of the gallows open. The rope snapped taut with the weight of the body and stirred the nearby roosting pigeons into an abrupt and ceremonious flight. Prisoners on the other side of the divided yard watched as the birds soared overhead and marked the sky with another declaration of execution. In Fremantle Prison, their wings were the only marker for the hanged man. Eric Edgar Cook was born on February 25th, 1931, in a suburb of Perth, Western Australia. At this time, Perth was still a developing and quite rural town. The population had boomed to over 60,000 after a gold rush in the late 19th century. Perth maintained a timid peace as its transition into the source of the state's resources. Cars were very often left unlocked, with keys still in the ignition. Trust was something that they didn't have to speak of. It was understood between most neighbors. Most of these residents would sleep outside, laying in their yards or on their patios. Safety was an expectation. It had yet to be violated. But Eric's crimes began in the late 1940s. As a young man, he was satiated by petty theft and vandalism. But in 1958, grown into both a husband and a father, Eric Cook's criminal urges turned horrific. Okay, so the thing that I noticed here first is obviously the things he was doing as a young man, where it's like he was just kind of stealing and doing graffiti. These things are very common to young guys, young adult males that don't have much going on. So that's not too strange, okay? But to continue on, to progress, to start doing worse things, that's where, you know, there's an issue. There's got to be a certain point where you have to grow out of it. And it looks like this fella did not. But of course, I know nothing about this Australia area, so it is interesting to see that, hey, even in Australia, young men are stealing and vandalizing things. Now, Cook went on to commit 22 violent crimes and 8 murders. By the time he was actually captured in 1963, Cook had the nickname of the Night Caller. He had attacked his victims with knives, hatchets, scissors, firearms, and more. He was a fiend. But again, also a victim. Eric Edgar Cook was born with a hare lip and a cleft palate. Even after 2 operations performed in his youth, he was left with a crooked mouth and a very noticeable mumble. The juvenile and handicapped Cook could do nothing to slow the wrath of the world as it closed in around him. Eric ended up being ridiculed and bullied most of his school life, but his home life was even worse. His father was violent, He was an alcoholic, and he would regularly beat his wife. When Eric tried to save his mother, his own beatings were especially bad. Christine Cook would sometimes sleep at the hotel where she worked just to avoid coming home to her husband, Vivian. Eric was left to hide under his home to avoid the violence. He would roam the streets to occupy himself and started seeking trouble, just to gain some semblance of attention. He was taken in by orphanages and foster homes that eventually led to nothing. Cook learned early on that he was alone, and the world was against him. But being poor and unguided as a youth, Eric was left with no other choice. He had to steal. He would sneak into garbage bins and into unlocked houses to scavenge for food. Eventually, his habits turned vengeful. He learned to hate his surroundings for rejecting him. Now, he didn't understand why the people had so much while he had so little. He would tear or stain articles of clothing and damage furniture in the homes of the places he would invade. He even set fire to a church after they refused to allow him into the choir. So see, your guy just wanted to sing. You see what happens to all these musicians that don't get an opportunity? Charles Manson, Eric Edgar Cook. If you give these guys, you know, a bass guitar, you might have changed their world. But on May 24th, 1949, Cook was sentenced to 3 years in prison. He had many counts of invasion, arson, and vandalism, and they finally caught up to him. The sentencing was kind of minimal and would only serve to strengthen Eric's criminal fortitude. He was arrested again in 1955 after his fingerprints were found in a stolen car. After the subsequent two-year sentence, Cook began wearing women's gloves while perpetrating his crimes. Essentially, he thought these would conceal his fingerprints a little better and slow the authorities as they tried to comprehend Eric's future crimes. Now, on September 12, 1958, Eric Edgar Cook watched Nell Schneider from behind the wheel of a stolen car. The engine was silent. The streets were dark. But Eric Edgar Cook continued to gaze through the windshield like a predator. He dreamed of the great life she must have led. He imagined she was the sort of person who frequented some beautiful social circles. All the places that Eric never got to visit. The engine roared, and Nell Schneider was tossed into the air as the Ford sedan crashed into her bicycle. She landed head first. She lay there bleeding in the road for 45 minutes before she was found. Nell was in a coma, but she survived. She went home for the first time weeks later. She lived the rest of her life as an epileptic. Now, she may have escaped the war of the unscathed. She may have sort of escaped unscathed, but Eric Edgar Cook had scarred her for her lifetime. He left that night strengthened by the sense of the newfound control. He didn't have to just steal from the people who had ridiculed him for his looks and his speech. He could hurt them. He could kill them. And he would. So again, the guy goes from being a young man who's left alone to survive on the streets by himself, very Oliver Twist, and something in him just feels like everyone is out to get him, no one's going to help him, he is legitimately alone, even though he's a father, he's an adult, he's a person out there in the world, has many things to live for and to fight for, but instead he's like, oh, instead of continuing to do just minor stealing or vandalism shit, he goes on to running a girl over with his car. It's just a massive escalation. And maybe that's where being alone becomes the biggest issue, is because nobody was there to sort of stop this from happening. To just pay attention and notice he wasn't okay. Because nothing's worse than finding out this information because of something incredibly drastic, such as somebody being ran over with a car. Just 4 months after the attack of Nell Schneider, the violence around Perth began to rise. 33-year-old Penina Berkman woke at 2:30 in the morning. on January 29, 1959. She had moved to Western Australia after her four-year marriage had come to an end. She brought her eight-year-old son, Mark, with her. In 1959, this beautiful woman was seeing a very popular radio host. They actually had dinner together earlier that evening. But the radio personality had no idea that that would be the last time he would see Penina. When Penina woke up, Eric Cook was standing above her. He reached out to restrain the startled woman. She fought, scratching him. Eric raised the stolen diving knife he'd brought into the home and stabbed Penina in the face. He split her nose in two. He stabbed her again, this time in the heart, and then fled the scene. Cook would explain the deep scratches on his face as an accident undergone while playing with his four-year-old son. And that was enough to keep his wife content, even as police combed the area. Local law enforcement found nothing in the way of evidence, let alone anything that actually pointed to Cook. They would eventually have another chance to capture this killer. Because on January 28, 1963, Perth was celebrating a long holiday weekend. Rowena Reeves was seated in the back seat of a Holden sedan when she spotted someone watching her from the distance. She and her lover Nick August were enjoying a quiet night together. Nick did not appreciate the Peeping Tom's interruption, just like anybody would. August went on to throw a champagne bottle at the man who lurked in the shadows. It shattered, and with it, Eric's restraint shattered as well. He'd undergone so much already, so many insults, so much rejection. Eric Edgar Cook lifted his rifle and fired through the Holden's window. The bullet struck Nick in the neck, it tore through him and lodged itself in Rowena's wrist. That's a hard sentence, not sentence, but two words in a row. Rowena's wrist. But anyways, the couple was still determined to escape. Despite their blood loss and the shock of the incident, Nick August managed to drive away and safely escape the Fremantle Hospital. But meanwhile, Eric's failure enraged him even more. At this point, he had to hurt somebody. So that same night, Cook spotted an open door above a Broome Street garage. He'd parked his car there. This opening seemed like fate. So he climbed up, over a railing, and into the adjacent bedroom. This is where Brian Weir was asleep. Cook shot the young man in the head from less than 4 feet away. The impact threw Brian into the air, and he fell back down across the bed. The blood drained from his skull and over the edge of the mattress. But Brian Weir survived his injuries. Before this incident, Weir was in great physical shape. His mind was sharp. He was studying to be an accountant. He was a member of the Nedlands Surf Life Saving Club. And his 29th birthday had just passed on the previous weekend. In 3 months, he was actually going to be married. But this bullet wound would leave Brian Weir in a vegetative state until he finally died 3 years later. But Eric Cook was not satisfied. When later questioned by police, Eric would explain.
A power came over me. It was an impulse. It was stronger than an impulse. It was as though I were God.
Eric, of course, was very much a man, but his wrath had not yet ended. Taking his car to the Nedland suburb, Cook's reign continued. He ended up on foot, prowling Vincent Street. On the veranda of a large house with a concrete porch, he found John Sturkey calmly asleep. The 19-year-old was shot and pronounced dead not long after. So he is sort of just picking people at will. But some of these people that he is choosing to kill, I have no connection to him, again, picking them at will, but they also have virtually no way in fighting back. The one person who fights back essentially survives. So it means that it's cowardly. Okay, this is the type of a serial killer that other serial killers would be like, well, we don't like you. The randomness, the abruptness, and the cowardice of just sneaking into someone's house while they're sleeping. I mean, what a scumbag. To go from simply, I was stealing stuff to survive because I'm alone, to, I don't know, I'm just going to kill people and then piss on their shirts. It doesn't make any sense. But that's why we do this type of stuff. That's the interesting part of the human condition and people in general. It's like, how did these people get to this? We've all been alone, right? We've all felt like the world was against us. But we didn't get to... Sure, some of us probably still steal things. You understand what I'm saying? Where it's like, yeah, I can afford it, but why not? It's getting back at a system that has wronged you, I guess. But to feel so alone that you gotta take people's lives and destroy their belongings and just be a real monster, it's obviously too much. And then to go and do it while people are sleeping. Like, it's one thing to break into someone's house while they're sleeping or no one's there, but it's another to just shoot somebody while they're in a dream state. But Eric retreated back into the dark after shooting the 19-year-old. And around 4 a.m., Cook rang the doorbell at a single-story brick house on Louise Street. And George Walmsley, a 54-year-old, opened the door. The old man was shot in the forehead. But Sandra Walmsley was also woken by the doorbell. She screamed for her father as she heard the gunshot. When she made it to the door, her mother was beside her. George's wife had to be pulled away as the blood matted his hair. They remembered him as a warm and loving man. They could never have expected him to be struck down so coldly. Now Cook then drives to the Narrows Bridge and dumped his rifle over the side. Ballistic studies would soon confirm that this same weapon was used in each of those shootings. Only then did Perth realize that the recent acts were all perpetrated by the same person. Doors were bolted and windows were locked from then on. The citizens of Perth slept with guns, baseball bats, crowbars, hammers, anything beside their bed in case somebody snuck in the middle of the night. Because 3 weeks later, Eric struck again. Cook entered an open back door and inside found two young women asleep in their respective flats. He cased the house for valuables before setting his sights on Lucy Madrill. She was alone and nearly naked. Eric knew that he could have his way with her. But Lucy woke up as he knocked a photograph from a nearby dresser. He lunged before she could scream and wrapped his hands around her throat. When she finally lost consciousness, he finished the job with a cord from a table lamp. Cook was determined to have his satisfaction. He slept with her corpse while the skin was still warm. In an effort to then mask his crimes, he dragged the body outside until the weight of her became too much to bear. Lucy was left in the yard of a neighbor. Before leaving, Eric lifted the empty whiskey bottle from the yard and plunged it into the woman's corpse. He needed to defile her one last time. So as we can see, his crimes are getting more and more just disgusting. Just horrific. I mean, he's so weak, he can't even carry the woman. I mean, how much is he eating? If he's doing all this because he can't eat and people don't like him, whatever the fuck his reasonings are, it's like, what do you need to defile the corpse for? It's so insane, dude. It's so insane. I should reiterate for the new listeners that it is rare that I know anything about these stories before I get into them. That's what I like. That's what you should like. And I essentially read the story and I give my take on it as we go. That's sort of the idea of the show. And that is why I am baffled right now. This is insane. But they always are. They always are. There's never a time where we're doing a story where it's like, you know, that guy really seemed to have it all together. 6 months after the murder of Lucy Madrill, Shirley McLeo was filling in as a babysitter for her sick friend. Shirley had been a top student in her high school. She was given a scholarship to the University of Western Australia. She was also known for playing basketball and hockey. Shirley's family just knew that she was destined for great things. Now, with the baby asleep, Shirley had settled into the lounge room for a night of studying. As a thunderstorm raged outside, Eric entered the home. The Dowd family discovered her still sitting in that lounge. A record still spun beside her. The room was filled with music. A cup and a saucer still sat on the table. For a moment, Carol Dowd thought that the university student had simply drifted asleep. But then she saw the blood. She had been shot in the head. Police were confident that this was the same killer who strangled Lucy Madrill. And this time, they found a fingerprint. Law officers quickly implemented an unprecedented procedure. They went door to door. Over 30,000 men were fingerprinted in this process, but they still got no closer to identifying the killer. In August of 1963, an elderly couple strolling through Mount Pleasant found an unexpected breakthrough that they needed. As the woman reached down to pick a flower from the nearby bush, she spotted a rifle. The authorities matched that to the murder of Shirley MacLeod. Soon, they set a trap, returning the weapon to its sanctuary but fastening the gun to the root of the bush. For 2 weeks, they staked out that location. At 1:30 in the morning on September 1st, Eric arrived to retrieve that rifle. He was taken into custody and charged with the murder of MacLeod. Faced with the hangman, he began to confess the remainder of his crimes. Among hundreds of break-ins and hundreds of thefts, Eric Cook was guilty of at least 22 violent incidents. Now that they had him, the police became fascinated by the killer's attention to detail. Eric remembered the placement of paintings, flowers, and other things as he burgled the homes. He remembered the exact increments of change he'd stolen from various houses. When the fascination grew boring, the police brought an end to Cook's confessions. They didn't care for how many more crimes he was guilty of. Perth wanted to see him hang. And so he did, but not before one final confession. He insisted for the umpteenth time, just minutes from being killed, that he was also responsible for the deaths of two other women. Previously, the police dismissed the claims. Two men were already charged and incarcerated for the deaths of Rosemary Anderson and Jillian Brewer. They thought at first that Eric's claims were only made to extend his trial. Removed from the context, they realized their oversight. Cook hoped that by coming clean, by convincing the authorities of his guilt, that God might forgive him for this. He realized that his power was superficial and that the only strength that he had lied in the weapons that he wielded. Eric Edgar Cook is still remembered as one of the worst criminals in all of Australian history. He defied the world that had rejected him until his very end.
"I had 55 bullets in that rifle," Eric confessed. "Isn't it lucky? I didn't use the other 50.
Well, all right, guys, that's going to do it for this episode of Monsters and Mad Men. I am sorry for the horrible accents. I do want to try to... I put that in there to keep it light, okay? To keep it from being so grim due to the fact that we're talking about so much crime and death and all that stuff. But I do hope you enjoyed the podcast. Rate and review if that's something you choose to do. That wasn't meant to rhyme at all. But if that is something you look to do to show your support, please don't hesitate. Because it does help the show grow. It gets more people paying attention to it. It gets more eyes on what's happening here. Even though I don't do this podcast often, it is a lot of work, and I hope you enjoy it. But until next time, goodbye.